Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the Four Corners Media Project. I'd like now to welcome Ziad Abbas. He is a filmmaker, journalist, and he's the associate director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. And he, along with the director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, or MECA, will be here in Santa Fe on Sunday, the 28th of March at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Congregation in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Vivian.
It's great to have you back. We were with you on the air about a year ago. This is a benefit for the Maya Water Project. What is going on with what is the Maya Water Project, and what is happening with water in Palestine right now?
Yeah, actually, the Maya Project, which Maya means water, actually. Maya in Arabic means water. I don't know if the people are aware of this issue that the Palestinians, they are facing a water crisis almost every year and everywhere in Palestine, in West Bank and in Gaza Strip, because the Israeli occupation actually controlling the resources of the water, and the Palestinians, they are not allowed to access the water and even to have to dig their own wells to get their own water. So if we go back to the history, that Israel, they used 82% of the water in West Bank and Gaza Strip, and 18%, only 18% goes to the Palestinians. Additional to that, that they have their own rules, their own laws, which they use to control the water, especially in West Bank right now. But in Gaza Strip, it's a different issue totally. After the Israelis withdrew from Gaza Strip in 2005, Palestinians in Gaza Strip, they find themselves in front of a big problem, that the aquifer in Gaza already polluted because the Israelis didn't take care of this water. Before, at the same time, they used to take, until now, they actually, they take some of the water from the aquifer in Gaza Strip. And the last researches and studies around the water issue in Gaza Strip, even a few weeks ago, CNN, they had a report about the water issues in Palestine. They said in the report, 95% of the water in Gaza Strip is polluted, undrinkable water, unhealthy water. And here when you speak about 95% of the water, it's undrinkable. It shows us how much our community there, they are facing this issue and facing this kind of a threat to their life. In addition to that, the Israelis, the last war actually, they bombed the purification system in Gaza Strip, which cleaning the water. At the same time, they bombed the other purification system deal with the sewage system in Gaza Strip. And they are not allowing the people in Gaza or the local community in Gaza to get the material to rebuild this purification system. In addition to that, that Israel, they control the fuels which enter Gaza. So even the small purification system with engines or generators, it doesn't work there. So we came with this issue actually in Gaza Strip after our project director, Dr. Munal Farra in Gaza Strip, she asked the children in Gaza Strip, what do you want from us, what do you want from Middle East Children Alliance to do for you as children? And after a workshop there in the Bridge refugee camp in Gaza, the children came with one simple demand. They asked, can we have a clean glass of water when we go to school? And if you think about it, something very simple, and at the same time, it's very strong when you think about it. Like the basic need to have a clean glass of water is not possible to have it in Gaza Strip. And when we did the follow up, we find out that the water is another important reason for all the disease in Gaza Strip, which affected the children, affected the women, affected everyone in Gaza. And Israel, with their policy, they use it as a collective punishment to punish the people, not just in Gaza, everywhere in West Bank and Palestine. So we decided, okay, we will try to do something for this issue. We searched in Gaza. We find a company there. They build a purification system, very simple purification system with a small capacity. like two kind of purification systems, and the one for like around 2,000 students and one for like 500 students. And they used 80% of the material from the local material in Gaza Strip. And many experts in this field and many labs in the world, actually in England and in France, they checked that and they find out this purification system really is doing a great job. And we in Mecca, we took the initiative now to start building a purification system in schools where our children and Palestinian children in Gaza Strip, they have the right to have a clean glass of water so they can at least survive and protect themselves from different kind of other diseases. This is the Maya project. So far, we have right now 7 projects built already in 7 schools and kindergartens in Gaza. We have other 6 projects coming in the way, and we have our campaign now. We are touring around in the States, and we are approaching different communities, different organizations, different schools, universities to support and collect funds to build the purification system in Gaza schools. This is the water project.
It's a little scary because if you have a country, Israel, that is destroying purification systems and you go all the trouble of building them, is there any security that they won't just be destroyed again?
Yeah, when you speak about this, yeah, absolutely. They are destroying everything. They are destroying the human being. They are destroying everything there. It's not just a purification system. But when you speak about a purification system, this is a small purification system in the schools. The possibility to survive better than when you have a huge purification system which cover like the north side of Gaza Strip or the middle side of Gaza Strip, because it's easy to bomb it and to destroy it. But if you speak about in each school or kindergarten, they will have their own a small purification system only will serve this small community. I don't think so it will be easy unless, which they did it actually in the last attack, they bombed many schools, it will be, they will do that. But we can't watching that and watching our children in Gaza Strip, they can't have a clean glass of water. We need to do that. We know that Israel is like, it's when I am living in the refugee camp, we know that Israel is in any moment will destroy this building, but we rebuild it again. They can't destroy it again. We rebuild it again, back and forth. But this is the human challenge. You need to survive. We want our children to survive. This is through this project. We know maybe they will bomb it, but the possibility to destroy all the purification system, it will be less than when they destroyed a huge, like, big purification system.
We're talking to Ziad Abbas. So looking at the larger question of what is going on in Gaza and what is going on between Israel and Palestine at this point, update us. Where are we since I talked to you last year?
Yeah, Gaza Strip, actually, until I can say I don't say the same, actually, worse than last year. And especially when you go to the daily life of the people and you speak with them there on the ground, and nothing changed until now. Gaza destroyed, and they can't rebuild their schools. They can't rebuild their hospitals. They can't get material to have to clean their own water. When you think about this, small things, Gaza is facing like a huge, slow, we call it a plan for a slow death to kill the people there. And the people, they challenge that every day in their daily life. The sanctions still there. The Israelis, they're still controlling. Last night, actually, 6 people, they were injured in Gaza. The Israelis, they still continue bombing certain areas in Gaza, killed people, arresting people. At the same time, bombing certain areas where it's close to the borders, which keep the people in fear and they can't manage their daily life. Even children leave the school because when they hear the bombing, the shooting, running around. Gaza is a big jail. The biggest jail in the world right now on this earth is Gaza Strip. This is, think about like 1.5 million Palestinian, including children, youth, women, old people, etc., living in this jail, controlled. You have the electronic fence from the Israeli side, and you have the iron fist from the Egyptian side, and you have the Israeli Navy in the sea controlling everything coming to Gaza, almost everything coming to Gaza Strip. It's a big jail. It's a disaster. It's a slow death. And this is sometimes when you speak with the people in Gaza, they say we don't have other choice, only to challenge and to survive. But we need the possibility to survive, not to have a good life. They say just we want to survive. And it's politically, it's nothing moving around the world. They are ignoring, still ignoring what's going on in Gaza. And the United States of America, the United States government is still avoiding to deal with this issue on Gaza Strip. And no support comes to Gaza Strip. Everything is controlled. And, you know, it's like in a simple way. When I speak sometime with my colleagues there, my friends in Gaza, and they say, okay, tomorrow don't call us because tomorrow we'll not have electricity. The day after tomorrow they will have electricity because they don't have, like, electricity 24 hours. They cut the electricity from this side and shift it to other neighborhood, and it's moving like this. They can't have a refrigerator. They can't have everything like a fresh. It's really hard life there, and I don't want to say dangerous because now all the life of all Palestinians is dangerous, but this time it's, we are watching that and nothing happened in the ground.
I've seen the maps of Palestinian-Israeli land over the last half century, and the Palestinian areas keep shrinking and the settlements keep growing. What is Israel's goal? I mean, would they like to just disappear every last Palestinian, or what are they trying to accomplish?
Actually, I know the map you speak about, and especially you speak about something, even Netanyahu yesterday, he said that in his speech in the OBA and the ABAC conference here in the States. And he said we'll continue building settlements. And it's an incubation. It's an incubation started in 1948, and their plan is, it was established, actually, their plan it was to build a homeland for the Jewish people. And they had this myth, actually, Palestine is a land without people for a people without land. And they want to prove that by confiscating more land, building new settlements, change the facts in the ground, destroyed houses, planted trees, built towns, destroyed the history of Palestine, destroyed the Palestinian identity, destroyed the Palestinian spirit and national spirit. And this is what Israel is doing. And they do that in front of all the world, the confiscation lands, which all the world, they say Israel should stop confiscating land and building settlements. They challenge all the world, including the United States of America. And we saw last 2 weeks how Israeli government, they didn't show any kind of respect for the American government. And they said that when Biden, the vice president, he was visiting Israel, and they continue confiscating land. And they announced about, about 1,600 new units to be built next in the coming few months. The settlements issue is related to the goal of the Israeli incubation, which they want the Palestinian people out of this land. They want the Palestinian people to make it difficult for the Palestinian. No land, people that are living in jails, there is a wall, military checkpoints, and to make it difficult for anyone to survive there. And the same, like we spoke about the water issue. They control the water, they control the resources, they control the electricity, they control the movement, they control the economy, they control the agriculture, they control everything. The only thing now Israel, they can't control it, is the air. And maybe in the future they will find a way to control the air, which the Palestinians, they breathe. But it shows on the other side, the Palestinians, they understand this policy. I don't speak about Palestinian government or Palestinian authority. I speak about Palestinian people. We understand this very well. And Palestinians, they understand this is the meaning of occupation. This is the Zionist plan to build. And they challenge this. They challenge this in their daily life. They challenge that when they go to school to study, even it's difficult for them to cross the wall or to cross the fence or to cross any checkpoints. But they know this is the part of the struggle which Palestinians, they are doing. I believe Israeli government, not this government, all the governments since 1948 until now, they have the same policy, no matter who's in the government. They want this land alone for them to build the pure Jewish state. And I don't think so they will succeed, because Palestinian people right now, almost 11 million Palestinians living around the world, and you speak of around 4 million and a half that are living in Palestine. So they couldn't do that. And they couldn't erase the Palestinian people. And we learned from the history that with people struggle, a lot of this reality will change. And eventually, I believe the Palestinian people will approach the stage where they will get their own political rights and live like any other nation in dignity and have a good future for the new generations.
We're talking to Ziad Abbas, who is going to be in Santa Fe on Sunday, the 28th of March. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Israel is utterly dependent on the United States, on American taxpayer money, to survive. What leverage do they have to keep this flow of money? Why does the United States offer them unconditional support no matter what they do?
Yeah, actually, I don't know who control whose. You know, if the Americans, they control Israel, or Israel, they control the American governments. I speak about governments in this case. Because I think this kind of support is coming from United States government to Israel. It's not just the money, the tax money, like the $3 billion or the $10 billion go to Israel, the $3 billion every year, or the $10 billion sometimes comes as a special donation, or the military support to Israel, or the Apache helicopters which bombed and killed many children in Gaza Strip and West Bank, or the Air Forces, or the Navy, all this kind of support like military. This is not the only support that Israel gets from the United States of America. There are the other kind of support, the political support, which, for example, the power that United States of America, they use it in the United Nations to prevent any resolution, to stop any resolution in the Security Council to condemn what Israel is doing on the ground, which tens of times the American, they use the veto. That the pressure that American they put on many countries in this world to keep the relationship with Israel and to support Israel, using their power to build this kind of connection. And I believe sometimes some people, actually, some Palestinian writers, they say it's the Israeli-American occupation of Palestine. It's not, because Israel, without the American support, they will not do that. They will not continue to do this. In this way, they will not, maybe they will do it for a short time, but they will not continue. And when you think about the American tax money, where it will go? It goes to the wall where they build the wall, 500 miles long, 8 meters high. It goes to extend the settlements and build the new settlements. It goes to the occupation army, which harassing and humiliating children, youth, women in Palestine. It goes to keep people in jails. It goes to kill people. And I believe that the American people, they need to take a stand, at least to clean this and not to have this on behalf of their names. Because for each Palestinian now, we know that the American, they are supporting Israel in each in every level, in all the levels, they are supporting Israel. And the American people, they need to take a stand toward justice. If the people, it's clear, you want to be with justice or with injustice. What's going on right now, it's an injustice. If the people, they want to be, to support justice, you need to take a stand to stop the support to Israeli occupation. And I believe, I say it all the time, this kind of money which goes to Israel, if it will come to California or to New Mexico to support the education system or to support the health, to offer health to the community here, or to support the new immigrants coming, or the marginalized communities in the United States of America, be sure we'll be okay. We are not asking for money from the United States of America, the government. We are asking you, please don't support Israel and use this money for your internal issues in the United States, support the education or health, or to support the new generation in the United States. And this is a pity, actually. And we're still counting on the American people to take this stand. We still count on that.
It bothers me when people use terms pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli or anti-Palestinian or anti-Israeli when they talk about news broadcasts and things like that. It just seems like the real issue is about human rights and peace. And you can be pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian and pro-peace all at the same time. And if you could give all this money to Israel on the condition that they use it for purely peaceful and peacemaking ends.
Absolutely. The idea of a pro-Israel or pro-Palestine is something used, I can say it, it's a terminology used in the media in order to deceive the public opinion and to play with it, actually, more than say the truth. What we learn sometimes, we need to examine what we believe. I want to examine if I am with injustice or justice, and apply this in all my life. If I am against the violation of the human rights, in, for example, in in Afghanistan or in Iraq, absolutely, I'm against the violation of the human rights everywhere on this earth. We can't apply it here and raising our voices against the violation of the human rights and ignore it in the other side. But here it's biased, I can say. The media, the people in leadership, etc., they are biased and they play with this game. And I, as I said, it's not the idea I want the people to support the Palestinian people. I want the people to support justice. We want the people to take a stand toward justice. We want the people to take a stand toward, like, the basic rights. Like, yesterday it was the International Day for Water, or the Water International Day in the United Nations. And especially now we are speaking about the water, which we have, like, 1.5 million Palestinians, 95% of their water polluted and unhealthy and undrinkable. And this is not just the Palestinian, they said. Even international, they say this. Even international community organizations, they say this. The people, they need to take a stand toward this. And if there is injustice, yes, we need to take a stand against injustice. We can't continue, like, saying, I don't know how the people, they can please the victim and the victimizer at the same time. It will not work. You can't please the people, they are losing their basic rights, and please at the same time the jailers. You can't please the prisoner and the jailer at the same time. There's the stand, it's towards, to respect myself, I say it all the time, I need to take a stand towards justice and against injustice, no matter with whom, which color, where, the location, etc. And this is the basic thing. But until now, I can't say that the American people in general are taking this stand, unless you will see the American foreign policy changed in the Middle East and changed in different parts of the world and changed locally, actually, concerning the other people needs here in the ground.
Do you see any differences in the media coverage in the United States and in Europe?
Absolutely, there are a huge gap between Europe and the United States of America. The media here, the role of the media here and the role in the United States, and the coverage, especially for what's going on in the Middle East, it's a huge gap. And I don't want to speak even sometime about CNN. CNN national here and CNN international, you see the huge gap too. Which kind of news they cover it there and which kind of news they cover it here. And here that this is a violation of the people's rights here, that they can't get the right information or the facts what happened. And because here the media, they are playing big role to hijack the people's minds and to keep it far from the truth and to, in order to keep them, to feed them with the wrong information. I can say the media in Europe and in different countries, the European public opinion shifted a little bit concerning what's going on in Palestine. First of all, the location is very close and the media there in the ground, and they can't hide the facts what's going on in the ground. Even some media, like as I can say in Italy or in France, TFA in France or the Rai TVs and radios in Italy, which for Berlusconi, the prime minister there, which they pro Israel, they support Israel, but they can't ignore everything. They show something, what's going on in the ground. And they show the story sometimes, close to the truth. But here it's different issue. Sometimes, believe me, when I watch the American news, Fox News, or watch the CNN or watch ABC and MSNBC, sometimes I feel that we are the occupiers, the Palestinians are the occupiers, and the Israelis, they are the victims. And this is how they play with it, unless, like, the people, they take their own stand, go to Palestine and see the reality, which they learn about that. And this is exactly what we call it brainwash, when you keep the people far from the truth and use the information in the way that to keep the people far from taking any actions on the ground. So they feed them in the wrong information. Media here, absolutely, it's controlled, and it's like far from the what we call it, like the education for social justice or education for human rights. It's really very far, and they use this kind of words, but it does not make any sense. They use it when it will serve their own goals or serve their specific groups of people goals. And I feel sad that this kind of democracy, what we call it democracy here in this country, and compare that to the media rule in Europe, absolutely, they need to take different kind of steps and stages until they will match what the European they are covering in their country. It doesn't mean that the European they are doing perfect job. They have their own policy. They are biased. But if you compare the media in Europe and comparing here, and actually if I want to be to go that so far, if you compare the role of the media here and the way how they cover what's going on in the Middle East to the media inside Israel, there is a huge gap. Because in Israel, actually, they are living on the ground there. They play with the media, but they can't ignore everything happened in the and they play with it or switch the facts that much. But in this country, they do it, and no one care about it.
Well, one of the things that I find disturbing is tapping into the stereotypes of Arab terrorists when the 99% of the people of Palestinian people are civilians who are just trying to live.
Yeah, actually yesterday I was with a group of friends and we were speaking and they were some American friends. They said, "Yeah, guys, we love to speak Arabic like you." I told them, "Yeah, you will love it here to speak around us, but when you go outside, you will hide it." Because the stereotype, the way how they look at to the Arabs, the Muslims, and this, it's in a way or another, it's like you are suspects, we call it suspicious. All the time as an Arab, suspicious, terrorist, connected to that. It reminds me of a documentary, and the filmmaker, his name Jackie Shaheen, the documentary called The Real Bad Arabs, actually. The Real R-E-E-L, Bad Arabs, and show how, for example, Hollywood creates this kind of stereotype. The moment the Arabs, they show, the way how they show the Arabs as a terrorist, they are misbehaving, the Arabs, they are not close to, sometimes they show it like Arabs with tails in the back, and they can show you in this documentary, actually, how this kind of films and the media dealing with Arab. And this is the sad part in the States. This is the reality. I was one time in one of the schools doing a presentation, and I asked the students, when you hear the word Arab, what the first thing jumped to your mind? And the students, they were like 24 students. 16 of them, they said terrorists. When you have 16 students out of 24, they say terrorists. The moment they hear the word Arabs, this is the stereotype how they created. And absolutely, the media helped a lot, and not just helped, they created this. And the people behind the media, they are creating this kind of barriers between the American culture or the people living in this culture here and the Arab culture, and make them prejudge the Arabs and even not ready to deal with Arabs. And this is the sad part. At the same time, in the Arab world, I want to say, the people, they are open to other cultures in general. And I can say in my country, if you go to my refugee camp, just the moment you show up as international, your face, and asking for any help, you'll find yourself in houses with families sleeping in their house, eating their food, because I don't want to say it like we do it like a propaganda, but this is part of our hospitality and part of who we are, welcoming the other cultures and respecting the other cultures. At the same time here, we are prejudged already. And just all the time you find yourself, you need to defend yourself. The moment you leave your house at morning, and even during the night when you are sitting down in your home here or in your flat watching the TV, you need to defend yourself because the news against you. And when you go to the Safeway or go to the train station or go to meet with people, all the time you want to defend the Arabs. Ah, Arabs, ah, you are students. Good for you. And sometimes, did you finish your university? Yes. Good for you. Like, you are an Arab. It's like something like, you should not be in the university. This is the stereotype. And this is how the media, actually, they, I don't want to say succeed, but the media, how they use their own power to brainwash the people and to create and build barriers. Sometimes we say it in Palestine, the American money helped Israel to build a huge wall to divide the Palestinian community. And here in this country, the media, they are building huge barriers between the American people and the Arabs, and not just the Arabs, the rest of the world.
There's a website called realbadarabs.com, R-E-E-L, which people can look at. And also, Dr. Jack Shaheen was on Democracy Now!, and there's clips from the film on that website. I think it's important sometimes for Americans to look not only at what our stereotypes, but what our stereotypes have been in the past that we got over. I mean, there used to be horrible stereotypes against Irish people, against Italian people. There still are racial stereotypes against black people. But there are many that, when you look at them, they just seem so ridiculous. And this is one that we're living in the present that I imagine in not too distant future will be equally ridiculous.
Absolutely. When I speak about Arabs here, maybe because we focus about the Middle East, but if you go back to the history, you'll find the same with our Latinos, the people coming from Latin America, with the African-American people, and the stereotype it was used in their education about the African-American, their movies, how they show it to the people and build this kind of stereotype. The same with the other, for example, the Irish, the Italian, even the Jewish people. And for example, and this is like to have such kind of system here accepting this and supporting this and accept that for their people to be brainwashed and to keep their people to put them in the stage where they can prejudge other nations and judge other people. Absolutely. This is something like the whole education system need to be changed and to challenge that. And this is like now I am like jump to my mind Howard Zinn and losing Howard Zinn in this period. It's really a big loss for the people here and for the people in the world, which the American education system need to be changed and raise awareness more about like how the communities can come together and minimize the barriers, and cross-cultural bridges should be built and maintain this kind of relationship with other cultures and not to be judged. But here, if I want to go to the Hollywood or go, it's like the American government. No president will be in the White House without the blessing from the AIPAC. And you know what's AIPAC, the Zionist lobby and the Zionist organization in the United States of America. And the same in Hollywood. You have AIPAC in Hollywood, where all the time they are feeding the people with their movies, with their etc., and approaching, creating a certain kind of stereotype and brainwashing the people. And the same you find it in the media, with this big media agencies here, which they have the same policy. And now, as I told you, as an Arab, I feel all the time I need to defend myself. Despite the fact I am very proud who I am as an Arab, I am very proud of my accent because I am at the same time, you will this kind of energy you spend it every day, it make this like something you need to defend yourself to explain to the American people.
I'm just out of time, so I have to go now, because otherwise I'll have to edit something out. So we'll just have to close here. But Ziad Abbas is a filmmaker, journalist. He's associate director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, and he will be here this coming Sunday, March 28th, at 7 in the evening at the Unitarian Congregation in Santa Fe with Barbara Lubin, who is the founder and director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, which is on the web at Mecca, M-E-C-A, meccaforpeace.org. And many more questions, which we haven't even gotten to yet, will be addressed on Sunday night, so everybody can come. And Ziad, thank you so much once again for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Valentine McKay Riddell. She is the director of the Four Corners Media Project, and Leslie King is a still photographer on that project, which we're about to hear about. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. We're glad to be here.
So this is a very interesting project. Why don't you tell us about it? It's based in Shiprock, New Mexico.
It's based in Shiprock. It came about in an odd way. I was telephoned by some folks in Arizona, Native American folks, wanting a donation. And I had just gotten out of a PhD program and had no money and said so. But I said I had a nonprofit and maybe we could help them that way. So little by little, I got connected, to these folks in Shiprock.
What did they want a donation for?
Just whatever. This was CIN, the Council of Indian Nations, that called me. I wound up, though, going through a Zuni friend in Berkeley who had personal friends up there in Shiprock and introduced me to them.
And so what happened?
And so what happened was I called the guy that she introduced me to, James Perry, and said, James, I want to do something to help these kids reconnect with the elders and, you know, reclaim their heritage and maybe also learn a decent profession. So James said, sounds great. Let's make a movie about it. But I've never made a movie. And he said, well, that's all right. We can try it anyway. So we just kind of got rolling in that direction.
And so now you are in an advanced phase of actually making this film.
Phase two.
It's
a
That's more advanced than phase one.
Right. Right. Incrementally
trying
advanced.
To make it progressive.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, we are. We're in what you call the productions, not production, actually, the development stage of the film, which means we're trying to gather everybody together, you know, get the film crew and the gear back up to Shiprock, you know, herd the kids.
And it's always more involved than you anticipate.
Oh,
and
Lord,
then
yes.
On top of that, you have to find the finance for it all.
Yes.
So what's the actual story? In other words, you found these young kids. Are they mostly Navajo kids?
They are all Navajo kids.
Most of them are pure Navajo.
So who are basically using the tools of film, which they are being taught through this project, to make films about their lives, their languages, their ancestors, their elders.
Right. It started out just doing elders' interviews and a lot of what we call B-roll, and Leslie can explain B-roll. The three-legged dog is one of the B-roll shots.
We just started filming interviews with some of their elders, like some of the students' uncles, who mostly told the creation stories of the Navajo so that we can preserve that story and try to understand it better. And then in addition to that, while we were out on the reservation, we would go out and shoot B-roll, which is just the panning footage, you know, the cut in between shots, the montage shots, you know, where it's like, oh, they're talking about Shiprock, here's some film of Shiprock.
Right.
So the students had to learn that whole process, had to be taught what that meant, the right ways to use a camera to pan across it, all I can think of is pan.
No.
There are other words for this, I swear, but for the type of techniques they had to use. But I think the students really gained a lot from it. And in the end, they all found their little niches of the whole process that they really enjoyed. Like, Shadar really liked the editing process. Jeremiah enjoyed using the camera a lot. I think everybody overall had fun with it just because it was the first time they were able to record something and see what they produced. And everybody, I think, was really excited the first time they got to watch their replay.
So what are they learning? Tell us some about the content that they've actually been coming across in the process of making the film.
Well, as Leslie was explaining, the creation stories, which we learned vary, actually, from teller to teller. There apparently is no such thing as one creation story.
Right.
Which is interesting. But we got two or three versions of why Shiprock is called Shiprock and what the two wings of it actually are. They are supposed to be the wings of a monster that the Hero Twins destroyed. The Hero Twins were the children of Changing Woman. You know, so there is just an enormous amount of mythology, what we call mythology, and what Navajo folks call teaching stories, involved in this process in talking to the elders. But what sort of began to intrigue me as we went along and in the months since, because this started in 2008 in the summer, I got to thinking, but what about the kids? You know, they're really living basically with a foot in two worlds. Because here they are, you know, living with very, very traditional Navajo families. Shadar, for example, many of her family are healers, traditional healers, and yet she is interested in archaeology, which is a huge no-no for, you know, traditionally raised Navajo people because of the prohibition against having anything to do with death, with the dead, with being in a place where people have died.
Yeah, you shouldn't mess with people's bones once they've been
nothing
set
like
in
that
place. You know, like they were there to have their souls set onto paradise.
But regardless, Shadara would be a fantastic archaeologist if she, you know, were able to break past that barrier.
It's interesting because we've had numbers of archaeologists on the program talking about getting Native people into archaeology, which hasn't necessarily been the case, and that gives us one clue as to why.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. I'm learning so much about these particular folks. I'm part Apache, but I know nothing about the Navajo except what I'm currently learning. But there's that, and then I got to thinking, so here are these kids. They're growing up traditionally on one hand, and on the other hand, they're fascinated with technology. Cell phones, you know, video games, the computers, the whole thing.
I love Macs. Love them.
They love Macs, and they just slide right into this kind of digital filmmaking process with in one afternoon,
right.
Mary Charlotte.
As
learned
any, as
everything.
Young, yeah, right, exactly.
One afternoon. It would take me years
right.
to do this. But in one afternoon, they were out there shooting film.
And I think that ability kind of alludes to their whole attitude and general culture of just accepting things as they are and being able to move so easily because of that, you know, kind of in any environment. And being the photographer, you know, it took them some time to get used to having a camera in their face all the time, but... After they learned who I was, what I was really there for, you know, by the end of it, they were ready to pose and making goofy faces and stuff like that. And, I mean, they were just so able to be accepting of me throughout the entire month. And I was really able to see this one time when they were playing hacky sack in this school. We were waiting to go out and shoot some B-roll. And three or four kids were just playing hacky sack. You know, they'd loved doing it the whole time. And... the feeling in the room was just so relaxing and calm, and it wasn't like these kids, these four kids who were playing hacky sack, were like, we're playing hacky sack, nobody else can join. It was like, we're playing hacky sack, if you guys want to come, cool, if not, we're going to be over here. And that whole feeling, I'd never felt that with teenagers before, in the U.S. at least, and it was just incredible to see the way they interact and how mature they are.
I'm glad you're saying that, because something that I've often found annoying is the construction of teenagers as nonverbal, difficult, impossible, rebellious. That's a total cultural construction that's put on them.
It is. They're individuals like everybody else. But it was unusual, I have to say, because I've worked with teens a lot over the years. It was really unusual to be in a room full of, and there were 8 to 10 kids in the room. Very quiet, very respectful, very attentive young people who really paid attention to Hank and Jillian, who were teaching them.
Now, Hank
Rogerson and Jillian Spitzmiller,
whom we've had on this show, who are amazing documentary filmmakers,
they're
working with these young people.
Mm-hmm. They were teaching them the technology, the ins and outs of actually filming. And the kids were just paying total attention.
So here you have these young people with, as you say, a foot in one world of traditional Navajo culture, and then the other world, sort of crazy U.S. technological. How are they handling that?
This is what the movie is going to be about.
Okay.
This will be the plot of the movie. We would like to have Shadara or Edward narrate, or both of them. They'll probably be interviewing more elders. They will be interviewing more young people. And what we want to do, the way I see it anyway, is flashbacks to the way it used to be, you know, in Navajo land, and then flash forwards to what's going on with these kids right now. For example, they did a whole series on graffiti. There was a great deal of graffiti under the bridge in Shiprock, apparently, and we had lots of footage of graffiti. You know, things like that. So that we see the contrast, so that we can feel the tension between, you know, trying to be respectful to the elders and honor the culture on the one hand, and then being pulled, just fascinated and pulled into this other, much more fast-paced world.
Yeah, to go back to your question, too, I think particularly for these students, that learning a new technology, especially... just open their eyes to a whole different world, you know, because before it was like computers and the internet and social networking, and now it's like, oh, electronic tools, cool.
So it's much more active.
Yeah, I think it's more engaging for them, and like I said, it just opens up a new world, you know, just like the first time you get a cell phone or, you know, your music MP3 player, and just like, wow, now I can walk around and listen to music and can be anywhere and call somebody. And it's like, wow, now I can maybe be a filmmaker and do something that's important to me, you know. So I think for these kids, it's just... It's just eye-opening.
It's owning the media.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Information is power, right? According to, you know, all of the folks who believe that and are providing us with the technology. So
you were in the process of making this film, and you're actually going to have, we're having you on right now because there is a little fundraiser to help support this project coming up this Friday, the 26th of March, from 5 to 8 at the Arte Bella Gallery at 235. Don Gaspar, with all sorts of music and food and raffles and lots of good things. What are you looking for from the public? Financial support, other kinds of support?
Financial support, if people are experienced and have worked with folks like this before, I would love to talk to them. I did at one point have a wonderful conversation with Lucy Moore, who wrote a great book, Into the Canyon. You know Lucy?
Yeah, right. She talked about that book on the show.
Yeah, well, she very kindly met us for lunch and sort of filled us in on all the reasons why some things are working and some things aren't. And, you know, so whatever. Also, if we do go for an NEH grant, which we hope to do, we will need a good board of, you know, very, what shall I say, formally educated and experienced advisors. You have to have that for an NEH grant, and we would like to do that.
So for all of that, you can actually call Valentine McKay Riddell, who is the executive director of Orenda Healing International, which is sponsoring the Four Corners Media Project. You can call her at area code 510-684-4272, and you can also go to Orenda-arts.org, O-R-E-N-D-A-arts.org. What else would you like to tell us about the project before we go?
The one thing that I think is really important for everybody to know is this. There is an assumption that we Western people know more, you know, do more, are more, have more to offer. And in my experience with the Navajo folks that I've been working with so far, it's not that way at all. The Navajo culture is so enriching and so amazing and so all-inclusive. There isn't any such thing as competition. I mean, people are really trying to help each other. And I think we could learn a lot from them. And so when we started this project, I remember talking to my crew. I had a whole bunch of folks working with me. And just saying, we're here to teach them a few things about film, but we are going to learn so much more from them, and we need to keep that in mind.
I think sometimes when people use the word poverty or poor, they sort of extrapolate that to mean poor in lots of ways, but of course there's a million kinds of wealth besides money.
Absolutely. And this particular culture is very, very rich in those respects.
And this particular project, I think, is just really important because, like you said, Valentine, about the learning aspect of the whole thing, there's a lot to learn from this untapped culture, many untapped cultures that are similar to it, especially in the U.S., I think, because this has been such a historic issue just from the inception of the U.S., and now we have to look at the progress that's been made, I think, and reevaluate how forcefully we need to set in place the next step of progress, you know, to change the way things have been and the way things are so that these people who this land is owed to, you know, can claim it back and be part of a society that they've been excluded from for ages.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even have a little bit of good influence on it.
Yeah.
Well, it needs all the good influence it can get.
That's without saying.
Valentine McKay Riddell is Executive Director of Orenda Healing International and the Four Corners Media Project. Leslie King is still photographer on the project. Once again, orenda-arts.org, and 510 is the area code, 684-4272, and the fundraiser is this coming Friday, March 26th from 5 to 8 at Arte Bella Gallery on Don Gaspar. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank
we enjoyed
you. It.
It
was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz includes a visit from Stephen Smith, conductor of the Santa Fe Symphony, and Artist of the Month, Horace Silver. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.